Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. For a little more than 2 years, Tim Wolf has been the man at the top at the University of Missouri. He moved to the presidency at Mizzou from the corporate world, but was no stranger to the community. He grew up in Columbia and attended the University of Missouri. He has settled in since he joined us on this program 2 years ago, and while there have been many things to celebrate at the university, including the naming of a new basketball coach this week, there have been some negative headlines, too. It all goes with the territory in today's world and the way the media sees it. I'm Don Marsh, happy to welcome Tim Wolf, president of the University of Missouri System, to our studio. Tim, so nice to see you again.
Great to see you, Don. Thanks for the invitation.
I have to start with the elephant in the room, and I'm sure you expect to have to talk about the sexual assault problem on our campuses today. Mizzou has been a part of this at one point. The president is getting into the act with the guidelines that are being put out. 55 institutions were named today as having, by the feds, as having acted inappropriately in dealing with sexual assault cases. You've got a committee out there, consultants out there looking at the situation in Mizzou. Can anything realistically be done about this situation? One in five young women on our college campuses is a victim of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, the answer is simply yes. There is something that can be done about it. And it's regarding training. It's regarding making resources available, giving clear understanding to students, both male and female, as to what the resources are that are available, as well as giving them information in terms of when they're in difficult situations, how to remove themselves from difficult situations, but more importantly, having them being active bystanders and removing their friends from difficult situations that could turn into an assault or an issue. And so there is more resources and more best practices that can be applied to prevent sexual assault and harassment from occurring.
You're expecting a report from the consultants who are looking into the situation at Mizzou in just a couple of days, I guess.
We are. Now, let me just characterize what the consultants are doing as compared to the work that was done by the outside counsel. We had an outside counsel, Dowd Bennett, great firm here in St. Louis, that investigated the matters pertaining to Sasha Menyukuri, who was a student athlete on our campus that tragically committed suicide after she left our campus. And the conclusion of that report was that while she was on our campus, we dealt with her as best we could. Our mistakes that were made was in the reporting of the information that we received, some of it, most of it after she left the campus. The reporting and the investigative responsibilities defined by Title IX wasn't as clear as it should have been. And the good thing was when I challenged after the ESPN news story broke that week, and I challenged the board of curators to hire outside counsel, have outside counsel report directly to the chairman of the board so that we could ensure that that outside counsel could look at all matters and all people pertaining to the relationships and what they knew about the Sasha Menyukuri situation. But at the same time, I asked our four chancellors of our four great campuses to set off on an investigative very specific project that was three phases. One, let's inventory what you do, define your practices, define your policies, define the resources that you have. And that first phase was completed. Before the first phase was completed, it was clear that we were not consistent relative to defined reporting and investigative responsibility as it pertains to Title IX Dear Colleague Letter. So I issued an executive order before the Dowd-Bennett outside report was submitted that says we need to have that policy more explicit on the four campuses across the system from a reporting responsibility investigation. As we thought, I mean, we didn't know because we didn't see the report. We thought that Dowd-Bennett would also be consistent with that. And in fact, they did come in with that consistency. So now after phase one, we're in phase two, which is let's assess the effectiveness of our policy practices and resources as much data-based as possible. That's where we're bringing in the consultant. And to your point, Don, is this consultant, who is a well-known national expert in sexual assault, mental health, Title IX situation, they are taking a look at the inventory of practices and policies and resources that we completed in phase one. And they're assessing that against best practices in higher education in total. The reason why we wanted to bring somebody outside is we believe assessing ourselves against the golden standard is really what we want to be. And the goal is that the University of Missouri system and its four campuses have the most safe and secure environment for students and staff and faculty, and have a culture of respect for each other. We want to be the gold standard across the nation. And so, having that outside opinion, which we will get early next week and share with the general officers, is important. And then that leads to the final phase, which is the recommendation phase. And so, in the recommendation phase, we're going to wrap in what the consultant says about assessing the inventory of work that we've done. We're going to wrap in the Dowd-Bennett report, and we're going to wrap in the recommendations made by the campuses. And I've already pledged support, financial support, to invest in the areas that will promote more education, more training, more awareness, more prevention of an assault or harassment, or more resources for those people that have mental health illnesses. So we've been on it for quite some time. We're happy to see the White House also pledge their support and give some recommendations on some things that they feel other campuses should get to work on. But fortunately, everything that we've seen so far from the White House is consistent with what we're already working on.
Does that 1 in 5 figure hold up, do you think, at the University of Missouri throughout the system?
Well, Don, that's a great question. So if you do the math of 1 in 5, we have 75,000 students on our four campuses, and about half is female. So that's 37,000. So follow me on this, because I've had to do this math quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So if there's 37,000 females, 1 in 5 is about a little over 7,000. So far, so good, Don. Yeah. So if it's 7,000 incidents and the national statistics on reporting is about 13%, then that would be 700 to 800 mm-hmm. reports. We're nowhere near. Nor near that number of reported, and reporting is captured in the Cleary reports, and Cleary reports is those that have filed criminal charges or gone down the criminal path. The number that we keep from a Title IX reporting or student conduct, we can't get anywhere near that number. So we know there's a lot of females and males out there that have not reported because they don't want to, they don't know where to go. They're concerned about the response or whatever, but our statistics aren't showing or comparing anywhere near to what the national averages are. So that's something that we're getting under. I can tell you, though, as you look at our statistics as compared to our peers and the trend line on our statistics as reported, we have a safe and a secure campus. That being said, is one incident is one too many, and we have to have that attitude and that approach, and that's what we're trying to do.
Why is this such a problem on college campuses? It reminds me of what we're hearing about the military, and you have these huge complexes, these institutions, if you will, in which this has been an ongoing problem.
Well, Don, you've got 75,000 18 to 24, 25-year-olds, and I can relate to I have twins that just started their freshman year in college. And getting out of the house and getting underneath mom and dad's thumb or watch allows them to make decisions that used to be reserved for their parents or was just decisions they couldn't make. And some students make good decisions. Some students make bad decisions. We know from studying this that approximately 90% of these incidents involve alcohol or drugs. And so if 90% involve alcohol and drugs and students are experimenting with alcohol or drugs, the probability or the propensity of a sexual assault to occur goes up. So if there is a direct correlation between alcohol or drug abuse and sexual harassment assault, then you got to look to where the drinking and drugs are taking place and try to have preventative measures and methods and education regarding the implications and the ramifications of drinking and drugs. So part of that is more education. Part of that is more awareness. Part of that is more making sure that you've got healthy environments. And then you also have to think about we can't keep kids from drinking or experimenting with drugs. We'd like to, but that's something that is a challenge, a never-ending challenge. But what you can do is start to educate the people that are around them if an individual gets in a difficult situation. And we've got some great education that we've been using for our students as part of student orientation before they come on campus, as well as reinforcing that once they're there. It's called green dot training, which you're basically taking a red dot, which is somebody that's in a bad situation, and replacing that red dot with a green dot by putting them into a safe situation. And it's really about friends helping friends. And it's really about bystander intervention.
How about the bars themselves in town? Columbia's got a few of them.
We have a few of them. Again, that's part of the education as well, is that for those bartenders or owners of bars or whatever, they too should be part of the solution and seeing where situations are getting out of hand or somebody has had too much to drink or whatever. So the education, you have to think about the education extending beyond the boundaries of the people that we employ or the students that we've got on the campus. And having community involvement in that is an important aspect of it as well.
We have to take a break in a moment, but in moving from the corporate world to the world of academia, did you anticipate these would be the kinds of problems that you'd be dealing with and that they would be priorities for you?
No, that wasn't part of the interview process, Don. There's a great deal of fun and rewards to this great opportunity that I have. That being said, there's a lot of challenges. This is just one of the many challenges that I've encountered in the 2+ years I've been here. The positives most assuredly outweigh the negatives. Unfortunately, the tragic incident with Sasha Menyukuri opened our eyes, and it opened our eyes in a way that we're not going to say it's a one-off and let's just move on. It opened our eyes in a way as we can be better than this and we can do something about it. And so what I'm passionate about is we're going to learn from this, as all good institutions do. When mistakes are made or tragic incidents occur, you learn from it. You learn from it, you understand it, and you move forward and make sure that it doesn't happen again. And that's what we're doing, is we're taking this opportunity to learn from it and improve.
You're listening to Tim Wolf, who is the president of the University of Missouri System. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Eventually, we'd like to get you, our listeners, into this conversation, and you can do so by giving us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You could send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, do so at STL on air. Back with Tim Wolf in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with the president of the University of Missouri System, Tim Wolf, in just a moment. But here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Democratic Governor Jay Nixon is expected to veto legislation this afternoon that would cut income taxes for more than 2 million Missourians and thousands of business owners. He cites concerns about its potential hit on school funding. The Republican-led legislature has vowed to try to override his veto. The group that wants to take legislative redistricting powers away from Illinois lawmakers says it has almost twice the signatures needed to let voters decide the issue in November. A nonpartisan group called Yes for Independent Maps is expected to submit 532,000 signatures to the Illinois State Board of Elections in Springfield today. The measure would create an independent commission to draw a new political map for the legislature every decade. And the board overseeing St. Louis Public Schools is expected to vote tonight on a transformation plan put forth by Superintendent Kelvin Adams. The plan has been somewhat controversial because it would, among other things, allow for a nonprofit operator to be brought in to help fix underperforming schools. You can hear more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day on stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Tim Wolf. Tim, we just read that story about Governor Nixon expected to veto that tax cut program. That would impact the University of Missouri. You have a tuition program that is tied very much to education funding.
Correct. And one of the things that we think about when we think about tuition is we want to make the University of Missouri system and its four campuses, as well as all public universities, as affordable and accessible to all students in the state of Missouri. It's our mission is defined by the Constitution. So we want to keep tuition low, and Missouri public institutions have been number one from a state standpoint in terms of the lowest tuition over the last 5 years, number one of all states. So we have done a great job of keeping tuition low. One of the things that we've done recently is recommended to the Board of Curators, and the Board of Curators have agreed that we'll keep tuition flat year over year. And that was based on the expectation for significant incremental investment by the state in terms of a 5% increase in core appropriation, as well as some capital projects, both for maintenance and repair, as well as new buildings. So I'm encouraged that the General Assembly and the governor will agree to a significant increase in core appropriations, as well as the maintenance and repair that's badly needed, as well as new buildings that will allow us to continue to keep tuition flat. The question that you posed relative to this tax legislation is a complex one. And as you know, my 30 years past is business, not higher education. Yeah. So my 30 years of experience from a business side standpoint says I actually like tax breaks, and I like, from a business perspective, incentives where they make sense. But when I was thinking about locating a new business unit in a particular state, I didn't first say what was the tax break or the tax incentive. What I was looking for was the environment, and did they have the workforce with the right skills necessary for what I was trying to get done. And so those were the things that I was looking for, which really goes to the quantity and quality of potential employees. And that's really what is concerning to me as the leader of higher education, is we need the necessary resources, regardless of what tax policy is implemented. We need the necessary resources to provide a quality product and provide access to as many students as possible. We are not producing enough graduates right now. Based on the surveys that we've done with existing businesses, specifically in the area of our science, technology, engineering, and math STEM degrees. Right now, public and private combined are graduating about 9,000 students in the state of Missouri. The demand statement that the Department of Economic Development has is we need to about double that by year 2020, and to double the production of those takes resources. Resources in higher education is code for money. We need money. And what do we need money for? We need money for labs. We need money for classrooms. We need money to help those that need tuition support. And so if those resources don't come from the state, then we're going to have to put it on the shoulders and the backs of students and parents. We're going to do our best to try to get donor help. But right now, from a state funding standpoint, we're about 45th to 47th on a per full-time equivalent student basis. So we're kind of at the bottom, which is relative to other services that we offer to citizens in the state of Missouri because of our pride in being a low-tax state.
So if you don't get the monies from those sources you just named, kids going to school can look to more debt, which is killing them now. It's overwhelming young students, as you well know. You've got two youngsters in school.
I do.
You've got a real good idea.
I have a really good idea.
I'm sure. There was a program on NPR this morning in which two schools, and I want to be sure, one was Temple University, the other was New College of Florida. And what they're doing is they're eliminating certain programs, including some sports activities. One is eliminating a baseball team in order to save money so that they can keep the cost of a college education low so that these kids don't incur the kind of debt that's going on. I mean, is this where we're going? It seems to be working out quite well for these two institutions.
We're always looking for ways to be more efficient. In other words, reducing spend in areas that aren't in demand as it was in the past, and reducing expenditures on services or opportunities that we're offering to students that just aren't relevant anymore. Let me just kind of talk to you about, in the most recent Board of Curators meeting, we talked about how efficient and effective we have been recently, and I'd like to just share with listeners some of the statistics. In the last 5 years, we've seen an increase in student population by 18%. Over that same period of time, we've seen an increase in graduation rate by 19%. And the reason why we're increasing graduation rate faster than the number of students is we're increasing the retention and the time that students spend in graduating, which reduces student debt if you can get them to graduate in 4 years versus 6 or 7 years. But what's really an interesting statistic is over that same period of time, the cost per degree that we issue on an annual basis has gone down 12%. So our actual cost to educate a student and get them a degree and get them placed has been reduced. And we have done that through as much back office consolidation, like procurement, where we've centralized that and we're saving $20 million a year, and accounts payable and our benefit programs and our central bank where we manage all the accounts. And we've done a lot of great things to free up dollars to make sure that we maintain high quality in terms of the academic experience as well as the research opportunities both our students and our faculty have. So we have done a fantastic job, of becoming efficient yet being effective in terms of recruiting students and continuing to graduate them. Our applications are at an all-time high. We're looking at this fall at another 1,000 students on top of our 75,000 base. So we're very, very optimistic about the future. That being said, it's a never-ending journey of doing more with less. We've signed up for it. We know that's inevitable. And so every year we have to think back in terms of and think forwards, what are we going to spend our money on? What's easier now than what it has been in the past in making those decisions is we've been through a strategic planning exercise that clearly defines what we will look like, how will we be measured, and why somebody would come to our four campuses versus another alternative. That's that objective and strategy statement that's time-bound, and it also underneath it has the priorities. And so the priorities now are influencing the budget, when in the past, whatever we got from a budget standpoint influenced priorities. And so when you've got your budget influencing priorities, those long-term strategic goals tend to fall by the wayside. And sometimes you wake up and you decide, well, I'm not as competitive or I'm not as good because the strategic things I wanted to invest in, I couldn't do it because the money wasn't available. And so now that clarity of priorities and that alignment to a goal makes sure that we are investing in our future, not just investing in our past or present.
What role does online education, if any, play in your long-term strategy?
It's a huge important component of our success, and our success is really student success. The reason why it's important is we're getting better outcomes. There are students that are coming to our campuses that are a heck of a lot more technology savvy than what we were when we went to school, and they prefer to learn that way at their pace. Those students now have that opportunity. We are growing our online learning based on student credit hours, are based on the number of students that are taking at least one online class by about 30%, which is about three times faster than the marketplace. We have over 1,600 classes online. This is 100% online. You can easily double that for those blended ones, which is you do part of the work in your dormitory or fraternity sorority, and then you do part of the work in the class. But just from 100% online where you never come into a class, we have 1,600 classes, over 100 programs, and degrees that are available online. And if you see national rankings, we're in the top 10% in a lot of the national rankings. So we a few years ago really invested in that. We're going to continue to invest in that. The other advantage is it takes some demand off of the classroom. It also allows for more one-on-one advising or help because you can clearly see where a student is in his or her progress on a particular class versus, again, when I went to a class, you could be there in the class, but the faculty or the professor had no idea if you were paying attention or if you were lost or not. They really couldn't, especially in the larger classes where you just, when you're self-paced online, you can't get lost and you can't get behind. You're forced to stay on.
It would seem to me that this is where inevitably it has to go.
It is a piece of where it needs to go. So the dream or fantasy of everything being online, and there are certain business models for profits, institutions that are purely online, and you've read about those. Our mission statement and what we offer from a residential experience does not suggest that it'll be 100% online. what we offer as an advantage to an employer, what we offer as an advantage to students and parents, is that collaborative opportunity between a student and a faculty member, where you can apply what you learn in a book or apply what you learn in an online class to critical problem solving. And so what we want to produce is a student that has that subject matter knowledge, but also is very proficient in collaboration and innovative and critical thinking and applied problem solving, and hopefully applied problem solving in an internship or a live experience, so that when an employer hires one of our students from our four campuses, they are differentiated and distinguished from somebody that just goes to a for-profit 100% online. That's our business model, and we believe that that human interaction is critical to the success. So I don't foresee that we're going to be 100% online. That's not our business model.
I want to move back to the four-year graduation time, because we hear, and I'm sure you do too, a lot of complaints about that. You alluded to it just a couple of moments ago. Want to get youngsters out of there in 4 years instead of longer, because it costs more to go for a longer period of time. One of the complaints has been is that the institutions are set up in such a way that core or mandatory courses that have to be taken are filled so quickly that students can't take those courses and therefore have to hang around longer. What's Mizzou doing about the system doing about that?
Well, that is true in that we have capacity constraints on classrooms and sections for those mandatory classes that cause some students to take another semester or another year to complete their degree, which is really a shame. We need to be more we need to be better at forecasting demand for particular classes. What has changed on the university campus, again, from – I date myself, but back in the late 70s when I went to college, undergrad at MU, what has changed is at night when you walk on a campus between like 6 to 8 to 9 o'clock at night, it's packed. And the reason why it's packed is we cannot get enough sections done in that 8 to 5 time frame. So we have a lot more sections that are occurring at night, especially with access to lab and some of the other areas that we have a significant bottleneck. And so what we're doing to try to remove that pressure of not having enough sections or access to the teachers that are necessary to complete your graduation is we're putting more sections in place at night, even on weekends, to address that problem. And also, as I alluded to earlier, is some of the online education will allow you to complete the class without having to sign up for a section. You can do that online. And we're giving those choices more and more to students. The last thing I'll say about what we're doing to help students get through in a four-year period of time is we are now doing some early intervention. One of the challenges that students have is they start off in one degree program and change degrees. And as you change degrees, sometimes your credits don't apply.
Sure.
And so you can have students that graduate with 160 hours for a 120-hour program. And the reason why they had those 40 hours additional is they changed their careers multiple times. Or excuse me, changed their majors multiple times. So one of the things that we're doing is early intervention and introducing them to the different careers and different professions that come out of the majors that they are interested in doing. And introducing them earlier to that will allow them to make a more informed decision. The other thing that we're doing is major maps, which is we're going to put the classes in sequence that you have to take, so there's more planning that takes place between a student and an advisor, so they aren't surprised when they get to the senior year and they have to take the class and the class isn't available because the section is not full. The last thing that we're doing is there are those classes that are the real challenging classes for certain majors. And in some cases, those challenging classes you take junior year and you can't get through that challenging class, and then you have to decide, I've got to switch majors because I can't pass that class, unfortunately. Making those challenging classes mandatory early on in that major map will give the insight to the student as to whether or not they can get through that class and they should continue on that major path. All these best practices and insight cost resources, but it's the right thing to do, because what we want to do is graduate students. It's not that we don't love them, but we want to get them in, get them passionate, get them educated, and get them out. Because If you have them after 4 years, that seat that they're taking in the class should be used for somebody else. And so we want to get them in, get them out. And in terms of the undergrad, if they want to stay on for a master's, that's fine. But that is the business cycle, and that's what's important, is to try to be as efficient by getting them in, getting them passionate, educating them, and getting them placed in their area of passion.
That's a different slant on it. Many people think that you want to keep them there for an extra year to get that extra dollar out of them.
There is that point of view. It's not shared by me. I think that, again, back to your point, Don, is when you have two freshmen and you're paying those bills, you don't want to be paying those in year five and six.
I'm sure you hear from parents about this sort of thing.
We do.
Before we take the next break, very quickly, it appears the Obama administration is moving ahead on a college rating system, mm-hmm. which would tie federal aid to these institutions to various standards. You for that or against it?
Depends. Sorry to be ambiguous about it. The challenge that you've got is you should hold institutions of higher education accountable. And we've been accountable and transparent for 5 years now. It started with my predecessor, President Gary Forsey, who put in accountability and transparency measures, 80 measures that were for all four campuses. So we measured each of the four campuses on 80 metrics, like how many students are you retaining? Like how many – what's your percentage of your student population that's underserved minorities and female versus male? Like what are they doing in terms of graduation rates? Like what are they doing in terms of student debt? I mean, all these key metrics. We, thanks to Gary's insight and leadership, put forth that plan and said that two taxpayers, two students, two parents, we are accountable and transparent, and to the political leadership down in Jeff City, we are accountable and transparent in everything that we do, and we're going to be publishing these statistics. So when we put that in place, and Governor Nixon asked for a performance measurement system, which we fully supported because we've been doing it for quite some time, it was easy for us to not only depict where we are, but easy for us to show progress because we've been at it for quite some time. So what President Obama is doing is directionally correct, because a lot of the federal funds, specifically in like the millions and millions and billions of dollars that are allocated towards like federal scholarship, the Pell Grant program, are going to individual students that aren't using those dollars, unfortunately, for education or higher education purposes. It's a car, it's a mortgage payment, it's or whatever. And it's also being used in institutions that aren't showing any progress. They're not moving towards completion or towards a degree. And so the accountability standards of how those federal funds are used from a scholarship standpoint, from a research standpoint, is appropriate. Now, one of the things that is one of the criteria that they're looking at is the last one, is how do you measure colleges that have significantly different mission statements, they serve significantly different demographics. How do you measure them on that standard of quality, which is a standard of job placement and how much somebody makes? And there's that one statistic that's out there that I think it's aspirationally correct. How do you measure that in a way that includes all those different institutions? Is that maybe response that I gave you? So I think what he is after makes sense. It's all about the implementation, and it's not a one-size-fits-all. That's my fear.
That's Tim Wolf, and he's the president of the University of Missouri System. We'll take another break and come back, continue with our questions and yours. 382-8255 is the phone number. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or a tweet at STL on air. Back with Tim Wolf in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Tim Wolf, president of the University of Missouri System. Tim, one thing I wanted to bring up before we go to the phones is the affirmative action ruling by the Supreme Court recently, not directly affecting the University of Missouri, I don't think. But how do you view that?
I think it's positive. We recognize that there are differences in terms of economic advantages with the different demographics and that we have to serve. Our mission statement about serving all 6 million Missourians and making the University of Missouri System, which is the public land grant research institution for the state of Missouri that was constitutionally established, our mission is to serve all 6 million Missourians. And we would like to look at our student population, and we'd like that to match map from a diversity standpoint as well as from an economic standpoint, the population of our high school graduates. To do that, we recognize that there are the haves and the have-nots. And we recognize that there are certain families that will pay more for tuition than other families. That's a reality. And it's also consistent with the FAFSA form that everybody fills out that also makes certain students eligible for federal scholarship and others not, again, based on family income. And so using those dollars to help those students based on their nationality or their economic background, help them come up with a way financially to go to the to college is what we're all about. And the ramifications of another ruling in terms of all those programs was quite significant.
Yeah. Well, it certainly has captured the attention all across the country, needless to say. Let's bring in some of our listeners. And Stacy's been very patiently waiting, so let's get her into the discussion. Go ahead, Stacy.
Hi. I am really glad to have the opportunity to talk to President Wolf. I have loved UMSL and think it's a really great school. And I'm glad that he brought up the idea of creating a respectful and safe environment on campus for everyone. I think you can't look at the sexual assault problem in a vacuum, that if you have an environment where everyone feels valued and respected, then that goes a long way towards addressing the idea that somebody can take advantage of another person. And unfortunately, on the UMSL campus, you have a really serious problem with how staff can be treated, particularly by faculty members. I've seen this in many instances, and I've experienced it personally, where you have staff, in one case, you have a staff member who's a professor of labor management who manages staff and is a bully, basically. And you bring that to the attention of the administration, HR has said, well, we've tried to address this issue about faculty not really knowing how to manage. You know, they know how to teach, but they really don't know how to manage. And the faculty don't want to hear that. And, you know, the administration just basically says, well, you know, there's nothing we can do about that. And there are many stories like that where.
All right. Stacy, thanks for the call. Tim, you want to address that complaint?
Sure. Stacy, thank you for speaking up. So let me give a perspective without knowing the individual details just from what you said. But let me talk generically. The comment that I made about respect is absolutely appropriate. Faculty to staff, staff to faculty, faculty to students, students to students. I mean, it's all over the board. And that's something that you have to work on a continuous basis. And for those that don't have that respect, you have to get underneath as to why that's the case and address that as quickly as possible. One of the things that we have to do is invest more in our leadership, be it managers or individual faculty members or staff members, and that education hopefully opens their eyes, minds, and ears to what is appropriate respect that you should show to your colleagues, as well as the people that you have the good fortune to manage and lead. And we have to do more of that investment to ensure that we've got well-trained leaders that are working well with their colleagues in a culture and an environment that's respectful and an environment that is focused on the right kind of outcomes. And that's a lot of work that we need to do. I don't believe UMSL is unique in that. I just suggest to Stacy and anybody else that's listening, if there is specific situations, continue to try to document and address those and escalate those, because those are things that we need to know about and fix. And I don't buy off on is we can't do anything about it. I think that's not personally my style. I don't think there's a situation that we can't work through or resolve. And I just you think that's a cop-out. That's just an opinion of mine without knowing the specifics.
I think it ties in with something else I wanted to bring up with regard to the affirmative action issue. You speak of the need and a desire to have a diverse campus and have a campus that is reflective of the population in general. Do you think that is the case? I hear a lot from African-American friends and acquaintances who are associated one way or another with Mizzou and say that there's really an imbalance there, that the black student there aren't enough of them, number one, and number two, they don't feel among equals on the campus.
Are you talking specifically about Columbia campus, MU?
Well, I'm talking about Columbia campus primarily.
Okay. I don't know the percentage off the top of my head, the percentage of blacks as compared to the total population and how that compares to the demographic in the state. I do know that UMSL, from an underserved minority, is the highest percentage of, sure, as you might expect, highest percentage of our four campuses, followed by UMKC. And I think Columbia would be third, I'm just guessing, and S&T would be fourth in terms of the percentage of minorities and the diversity of the population. The feeling by some of your colleagues that there's not the right quantity, not the right respect, resources, support, or whatever. If that is true, we need to figure out how to fix that. And I'm not saying it's not true. It's just that's something that we work very, very hard at, is trying to create an environment where people that have interest, background, or demographics, diversity, or whatever, have opportunities to flourish and feel an equal. And that's the cultural respect. So I don't know why that feeling is that way. One of the things that the White House is recommending is a climate survey of students. That was what just came out the other day. And that climate survey is around safety and security and what they would do if they were harassed or assaulted sexually, as well as if they had mental health issues. And so these climate surveys is a great way of really determining if, in fact, that's a problem. What are the root causes to that problem? Getting the people that together to truly understand what the issue is. And if you truly understand the issue, then you can address that through investing in certain resources or certain help mechanisms or processes. And so that's one, again, back to my earlier point, one of the things that great institutions do is they're sensitive to the needs of the students, staff, and employees. And one of the best ways of taking a check of temperature is those regular surveys. But the value of the survey is only proven by if you do something with the results. Mm-hmm. So get the results, understand them, come up with an action plan that by working with the people that you've surveyed, and report back to those people progress made against those investments.
All right. Let's take another call. Evan joins us from Baldwin. Go ahead, Evan. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes, thanks for the opportunity. My question is kind of a two-part question, and I'll summarize it as briefly as I can. For traditional incoming freshman students, what steps are being taken to kind of assess what required classes are most appropriate for freshmen coming in? I'm thinking about the reference that was made just a few moments ago about the overall goal being getting students in, providing an appropriate education, and providing them the opportunity for graduation and then moving on to work opportunities. There was also a reference to the number of opportunities to register for some of the prerequisite classes, and that can pose a challenge to the overall schedule that a student would have and could increase the amount of time required for their graduation. So when you look at it from the perspective, maybe different students coming in to a freshman class might be coming from a different background, depending on the education they had in high school for, say, communication arts. And maybe not every student needs to take the traditional freshman comp 101 class, if you know what I mean, kind of in general. Is there some sort of an opportunity where students can be assessed that maybe they can skip that class and move further, you know, toward their graduation, take that additional step? And I guess in a more specific context, if a student has already expressed an interest in, say, something like computer science, is there a way that they can focus some of those early classes more towards that goal, considering the point you just brought up recently where I think you referenced a number of about 9,000 students being graduated to address the needs for STEM positions, and that number, as a goal, we'd like for that to be doubled in the near future.
All right. Thanks for the call. Thank you for the call. Go ahead.
Yeah, Evan, both your questions really focus on how do we achieve success student by student, and that success is achieved by having a conversation with a student. And students come from sometimes they're freshmen right out of high school, sometimes they're transfer students, and so assessing where the student is in terms of their interest from a major or career path standpoint and what college or advanced placement or advanced credit classes that they've got or experiences that maybe they had in the 2 year or whatever, trying to assess that and determining what are the classes and what are the steps necessary to complete that degree in the most timely manner possible. Then the second question that you've got is, if you've got a student that has expressed interest in computer science or something like that, how do you front load those classes in so that that person can get up to speed and be as competitive as he or she possibly can? Those are all great questions. The way that you really have to answer or solve these complex questions is by having great advisors and great mentors. The challenge that you've got as a freshman, or a challenge that you have as a transfer, is you don't know that school because you're coming into it and you're somewhat of a novice. If you've been at that school for a period of time, perhaps you have upperclassmen or friends or colleagues that know the classes to take, the sequencing, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really up to the student to reach out, take the initiative, and working with an advisor, working with a mentor, working with somebody from the department, or working with another friend to try and determine how to get those classes taken at the time that's best for you and in the sequence that gives you the highest probability for success. Because many of these classes build on each other, and if you get them out of order, you get to be in a situation that you shouldn't be in because perhaps you're asked to do things that you're just not prepared to do because you haven't taken the prerequisites.
Yeah, he was asking about the question of devising a way to stop a freshman from having to take a writing comp class, for instance.
Oh, in terms of testing out a certain classes? Yeah. It depends upon what institution you're going to, what class you're talking about, what you have done in your high school career as well as your two-year career. I can't ask specifically about that particular question because it also is related to your major. There's a lot of complexities about that.
We have a note here from our producer saying black students made up 7% of the university student population in the fall of 2012 compared to 11.6% in 2010. That's according to the university's diversity website. So 7% student population, 11 to 12% statewide. Very, very quickly, because we only have about a minute and a half left, your take on the unionization of athletes in college.
Great question, Don. That's another scary situation. What they're looking at, I think, as I've read the case and the merits and the justification behind it, is about the NCAA responding to some of the needs of student-athletes, specifically in terms of those student-athletes that have been hurt and still require medical care after they left the university. Yeah. That seems to be the essence of it, and I think that that legitimately needs to look at. The full, complete unionization of it is going to cause multiple problems, and it could result in things as, I believe, horrific as not being able to afford other college teams. There's just ramifications that I'd prefer not to go down to having to announce that we have to cut one of our female great sports programs or male sports programs because the unionization has forced us to direct more money into a particular program that's more revenue producing, like a football or a basketball, as compared to the non-revenue producing. My concerns.
Only 30 seconds left. What kind of a grade would you give the NCAA?
We're in the middle of the semester. We haven't had final grades. Yeah. Challenging. It's challenging, but they're working on it.
Yeah. That's a subject of a program in and of itself.
It
a
is.
Lot of controversy with that organization. Tim Wolf, thanks so much for being with us. It's always good to see you, and keep up the work down there in a very busy campus and a very busy system.
Thanks, Don.
Thanks for being with us. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk about the St. Louis Mercantile Library's fine print, rare book, and paper arts festival. He'll also take a look at a new app that enables anyone to create and share a video game. And we'll talk with author Elaine Wiese to find out how cats figure into her latest dead-end job mystery. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll examine how a small town in Missouri is trying to piggyback on the success of a hit television program. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Amanda Hunnigfort, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.